It is 3:06 on Friday afternoon. This is Political Rewind, coming to you as usual, live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. We are going to talk about the media and Donald Trump today. And I have to be honest, this wasn't something that we decided we had to respond to yesterday over. In fact, we last week decided that there were enough things happening in terms of the relationship between President Trump and the media that we should put this show together. But certainly that epic news conference yesterday and the president's remarks about journalists make this show even more relevant than it might otherwise have been. Joining us, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim, you got a column coming out in the Sunday paper, and I see, you know, you're working on it. What's it going to be about?
It's going to be on whether maybe Democrats thinking that Sally Yates is going to be the next their next candidate for governor, maybe they ought to steel themselves for disappointment.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a likely. We'll have a conversation about that at another point in Political Rewind. I think I'm on your side on that one. Brian Robinson joins us. He's a Republican strategist, and he really made his mark as the communications director and deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Nice to have you back with us, Brian.
Always great to be here.
And a real pleasure to welcome back Hank Klibanoff. Hank was the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He was the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. He now teaches journalism. It says you're a professor of practices. What does that mean?
That means I'm not yet perfect. As if everyone didn't know that.
But you're a journalism professor.
Yes, I teach a range of journalism and history courses.
We should also say, Hank, you wrote one of the most fascinating meaty books on journalism and 20th century history and politics that I've ever read, and you won a Pulitzer Prize as well. You should have, you and your co-writer, The Race Beat. And anybody who hasn't read this book that tracks how journalism covered the African-American community before civil rights and then through civil rights, it's a must-read, The Race Beat. And I just want to make sure we get to promote that.
Thank you.
Okay.
And Hank is hoping today to make President Trump angry enough at him that he tweets some terrible things about Hank,
right,
so that people will then go
so
by.
The Race Beat is so overrated.
Yes, yes. The failing Race Beat.
Sad.
All right. We're working. Bob Garfield is in the studios. He, of course, is the co-host of On the Media, and they're working to try to get him connected. Jenny Ament and Taylor Morris in our control room are working on it. They're having some difficulties right now. I hope we get them resolved because we'd love to have Bob join us. But I'll tell you what, let's start the show. We really do, of course, have to start with what happened yesterday. Tyler, if we could, let's start with how Donald Trump started yesterday's news conference.
I'm here today to update the American people on the incredible progress that has been made in the last 4 weeks since my inauguration. We have made incredible progress. I don't think there's ever been a president elected who in this short period of time has done what we've done. A new Rasmussen poll, in fact, because the people get it. Much of the media doesn't get it. They actually get it, but they don't write it. Let's put it that way. But our new Rasmussen poll just came out just a very short while ago, and it has our approval rating at 55%.
So that's how he started. And as we tell you about that, Bob, I understand you're joining us by phone now. Is that right?
That's true. Slight technical problems, so I apologize.
Bob, we're just happy you could join us. As I just introduced you as the co-host of On the Media, we air your show with Brooke Gladstone here on the GPB radio network Sundays at noon. And I'm also very glad to say it follows our weekend show, Two Way Street. So thank you for being with us.
Well, delighted to join you in every which way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. let's start by talking about the way Trump began that news conference yesterday, Jim, because the clear message from the moment he took, well, from almost the moment he went up on the podium, seemed to be two things. Number one, I'm getting hammered by the media, which means my message isn't getting out. And number two, none of the people I rely on as my mouthpieces are able to accomplish it. I'd better do it myself.
Right, right. And I got the thing lasted 77 minutes. That's a long press conference. That is and the thing is, you could see that this was his idea. He wanted this thing to happen. The ostensible purpose was the announcement of a new Labor Secretary nominee, and he shifted away from that immediately, went right into the fact that the dozens or hundreds of reporters in front of him weren't getting his story right.
You know, Bob, we've had elected officials at many levels who think they can bypass the media and talk directly to the people, to voters. It doesn't often work out the way they hope it does it?
Well, Obama, I must say, was pretty much a master of it. You know, he gave very little access to the press, at least the national press. He cherry-picked what he thought would be accommodating audiences, a lot of local TV, a lot of cable stuff, a lot of entertainment programs. And he did very little by way of certainly giving one-on-one access to the mainstream media. And, you know, he didn't run into a whole lot of trouble. We called him on it, in spite of the fact of being, you know, Radio Castro. We were constantly criticizing the previous president for his inclination to avoid the messenger. The Republic has never seen anything like this, and I dare say we'll never see anything quite like it again.
Go ahead. Finish.
Looney Tunes.
I would argue a little bit on that point. It's certainly true what Bob is saying about President Obama trying to find all sorts of ways to get to the public, and he did it through talk shows and that sort of thing, as Bob pointed out. And yet, he was never able to establish the kind of soaring rhetoric, the kind of messaging that had inspired people, I think, to vote for him in the first place when he talked to the media itself.
Well, I don't know that he did. I mean, I think he was a fresh face. If you're talking about Obama in this case,
yes,
he was a fresh face. And I think what we saw was, even in today's technology and today's oversaturation, it doesn't take long for a fresh face to get a little wearisome,
yeah.
And we become quite quickly skeptical of all of our politicians, and it's in some ways it's a shame, but it has to do with just the 24/7 nature.
Well,
of
I guess the point I'm trying
to with the fact that once the campaign was over for Obama, he stopped campaigning and started governing,
right.
Which ordinarily requires a different set of communications tactics and messaging. Trump, of course. Because he's, you know, not quite the fully evolved adult that Obama was, has never stopped campaigning. He's still talking about the campaign polls. He's still talking about the electoral tally. In fact, you ask him almost any question, it's a magic eight ball. There's only eight possible answers, and one of them is for him to, recount his electoral supposed landslide. I mean, the jaws were dropped all over that room at the presser on Thursday. Mine was not dropped because this has been going on for, I don't know, 18 months. It's a phenomenon.
Let's listen to how things evolved after the president came out and said he wanted to establish for the American people what he'd accomplished in the first 30 days. That went south pretty quickly.
I want to see an honest press. I mean, I started off today by saying that it's so important to the public to get an honest press. The public doesn't believe you people anymore. Now, maybe I had something to do with that. I don't know. But they don't believe you. If you were straight and really told it like it is, as Howard Cosell used to say, right? Of course, he had some questions also. But if you were straight, I would be your biggest booster. I would be your biggest fan in the world, including bad stories about me. But if you go, as an example, your CNN, I mean, it's story after story after story is bad. I won. And the other thing, chaos. There's zero chaos. We are running. This is a fine-tuned machine.
Brian Robinson, you've been on the other side of this, trying to serve a governor of the state. Do you feel any sense of sympathy or empathy for President Trump as he does battle with the media here? Or has he made the mistakes that are now coming back to haunt him?
I feel empathy because I do know what it's like when everything that you do is portrayed through a negative lens. And, you know, you're working on something that's very important to you, something that you campaigned on, that you know a large portion of your constituency wants. And every time you communicate it is through some negative lens, that what you're doing is somehow corrupt. It's going to, you know, help your cronies. I dealt with that for really almost two full years in 2010.
And you could be pretty combative in that role yourself.
Because you break down. You break down. You sit there and you act in good faith. You put out all of this information. You cooperate with the media. You give them quotes. You give them access. And it's still garbage on the out. Eventually, you just kind of go ballistic. The thing that's different, where I don't have empathy for him, though, is that he has an advantage that we never had. You know, while Governor Deal now has a significant social media audience that really can move the needle, it's so big, we didn't back then. And Trump is able to manipulate the media and speak through the media. Even if he's upset by all the noise around his appearances on TV, from the negative commentary on CNN particularly, that it doesn't seem to matter to the people who voted for him what those people are saying. What matters is what he is saying. And that is a platform that I really envy.
All right. So let's expand this. Thank you for those comments, Brian. Jim, Hank, Bob, I think the question is, the onslaught was so intense yesterday and just really a ratcheting up of what was already the campaign against the media that was already going on. How does the media respond to being treated in this way?
Well, it's not just as a group. I mean, there were some very dreadful one-on-one encounters between President Trump and reporters. I mean, you single out a black woman with Urban Radio and say, "You're my contact now to the Congressional Black Caucus. Please set up a meeting."
All black people do know one another.
A Jewish reporter stands up and says, "Look, I know you're not an anti-Semite, but there we are seeing a rise in anti-Semitism," and you tell him to sit down. Right. There's a point at which we journalists don't know how to respond to this.
But that's the question then. So, Hank, then Bob, let me give each of you a crack at this. What does the media... Hank, if you were back in the editor's chair at the Inquirer, Philadelphia Inquirer, at the AJC, how would you be instructing your reporters to deal with Trump?
Well, in a press conference situation, you just have to ask your questions and hold your ground and get your follow-up question. And there were so many questions I'm sure they left yesterday's press conference like they hadn't even asked. They didn't even get in a question about Bannon, you know, or any of these other issues that are going around because he – and you don't want to be rude. You don't want to interrupt. You don't want to be Dan Rather, you know, tangling the way he did with Richard Nixon. But sometimes you have to say, look, I have a job to do here. I want you to answer this question. You're still not answering the question. To me, he gets too much room to wiggle around.
And Bob, what?
In fact,
go ahead.
Permit me to come in on the back door on this. Remember during the when the NSA eavesdropping was very much in the news, and they kept talking about actual intercepts versus metadata. They were just collecting the metadata, so they knew which numbers called which numbers. They didn't actually have the content of phone calls and texts. Remember that? Well, of the 77 minutes of the press conference yesterday, no actual information was exchanged. Right. The president answered virtually none of the questions. The only way for the public to evaluate what took place was through the metadata, through his hostility, through his personal attacks, through his incoherence. So we learned some things, the public did, but we didn't learn them from the actual substance of his remarks.
So, Brian Robinson, you would contend. Go ahead, Bob, finish your thought.
So the exercise is not what it has been historically. It's more of the public sitting behind a glass watching somebody else in the shrink's office identifying Rorschach blots.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting that to amplify what you're saying, that even a number of conservative news outlets yesterday and this morning were pretty startled and reported it there how startled they were by the news conference. If you look at the cover of today's New York Post, for instance, it's got Donald Trump in a circus ringmaster's outfit. Wildest show on earth, Ringmaster Don whips media in epic rant. And that's a newspaper that's been very, very favorable to the president throughout his early terms and as a candidate as well.
You know, I don't think very many people, other than those who were just intentionally blind, are going to come away from yesterday's press conference and think that the media came off really badly. I think over time, if he does this and he overexposes himself, he will be overexposed as someone with, you know, who just speaks in the stream of consciousness, who has attention deficit disorder, who's not listening, who's not hearing the question, and who jumps all over people. And I think it will be bad for him in the long run. And I don't, and people will begin to wonder, well, what is all this about the press? Because we're not seeing it.
Jim,
you really think that's so?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think that the evidence so far is the opposite, that while the scales are falling from the eyes of about, you know, let's say 60% of the electorate, the other 40%, speaking of Rorschach tests, see what they want to see, and, you know, take the sort of Sean Hannity approach, which is that he gave the press the tongue-lashing they deserve and that he was it was a bravura performance, and he won the day. And, you know, I think people who pulled the lever for Trump, by and large, and the polling data seem to suggest this, you know, haven't run away from him. Rather, they're behaving like people who just spent, you know, $400 for a dinner for two that was inedible, but they walk out of the restaurant going, that was really great, lest they, you know, admit that they got taken.
So if that's...
And I see no evidence that the public is, you know, that certainly the Trump-voting public or the red states in general are rethinking their take on him.
Well, that's one thing that this 6th District race in Georgia will tell us, because that's likely to be a very Republican discussion about Donald Trump and where he's taking it. The one thing, the one thing that I'm hearing that I have never, ever, ever, ever heard before in political circles is open discussion of Donald Trump's mental state.
Well, and that's I'm glad you bring that up, because I think we have to talk about some of the themes that are emerging in the media right now. Bob, you did a piece for On the Media. This notion that that some reporters were starting to talk about a constitutional crisis because of what was going on with the Trump travel ban. And you all up there cautiously said, wait, we're not at the stage of a constitutional crisis yet. You've got E.J. Dion filing a column in the Post the other day saying, let's face it, let's stop beating around the bush. The man is unfit for office. There have been op-ed pieces that have questioned his mental stability. It strikes me that there are reasons for the Trump supporters to be concerned about whether the media treats him fairly or not. Yes?
And I stand by that answer.
I was thinking the same thing.
Under these circumstances, what constitutes fairness and what constitutes warning your audience about something treacherous that could damage the republic? Is that partisan? Is it biased? Or are we, you know, we don't, when there's a storm coming up the coast, you know, a tropical storm, and it's about to make landfall, we talk about the potential of the storm surge, and we don't worry about whether we're biased against cyclones. And, you know, I think that's the position that we have to take under these circumstances.
Brian?
Just one more thing, please. There was an op-ed in the New York Times that said, please stop saying the president is mentally ill. He's not mentally ill. This was from a psychiatrist. He's not mentally ill. He's just a jackass.
Brian.
Are we really having this conversation?
Yeah. Brian, why don't we get you into the mix here? Because I'm not quite. I do struggle a little bit more than Bob is suggesting with where the balance is. Not in, I mean, calling him out for yesterday's news conference and the way he behaved seems perfectly appropriate. But I do worry a little bit about some of the what seems to be hyperventilation 30 days in, less than 30 days in, about this guy's presidency.
You know, it seems to benefit all sides, doesn't it? The New York Times has got record high subscription rates. I mean, people for the first time in memory are like going and buying newspaper subscriptions. CNN's ratings are fantastic, as good as they've been in ages. Les Moonves, the head of CBS, said Trump may not be good for the nation, but he's good for CBS. It's because, you know, Trump is getting what he needs out of the media. He's able to use their platforms to speak directly to Americans. And obviously, he's connecting with a lot of them, a lot more than obviously the people who were sitting in those chairs in the East Room yesterday realize. Because those people in the East Room don't know these guys who are out there voting for Trump. And to be honest with you, I don't really know all that many myself. But the fact is, he is reaching a lot of people who like what he's doing. Chris Sillizza from the Washington Post yesterday showed a tweet in his little analysis of this. And the tweet said, I'm at a gym, and everybody in the gym is saying, hey, that Trump,
okay,
he's
but,
really giving
okay,
it to
but
him.
But I'm going to stop you because that wasn't, I mean, that's sort of deflection. I say that respectfully. Because the question here is, Hank, what's the balance here? I mean, is it appropriate to begin... should news organizations already be raising questions about Donald Trump's mental fitness for the job? I mean, it's one thing to have an op-ed piece. It's one thing for a columnist to write that. How would you pursue that as a reporter?
That's a very difficult one because that gets very personal. Certainly, he's abandoned his privacy. He's run for president of the United States. And in that way, all bets are off. The press is pretty free to go after whatever they can find. You know, they've already talked to a psychiatrist about, you know, at one point, and they've gotten access there. I think it's fair game to go after it. It may not be fair game in the end, based on what you find, to actually publish it. But I believe that you have an obligation to report it out and to pursue it, and then to decide, based on what your findings are, whether you're going to publish it.
Bob, Jim?
There's a couple problems.
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
Hank, one is this thing called the Goldwater Rule, which is an ethical rule for mental health professionals not to speculate on people who are not their actual patients. And then, of course, if they are their actual patients, then there's confidence. So it is hard to get psychiatrists, psychologists, and other mental health professionals to weigh in on this subject just because of professional ethics.
Well, I'm not suggesting that they should. I don't think that is a wise course of action. I'm talking about going to his own doctor who seems to have been willing to speak up before.
Yeah. The other thing is there aren't, oddly enough, a whole lot of mechanisms for the country if it is determined that he is unfit. You know, who gets to make that call? There doesn't seem to – they're just – I mean, truthfully, that's an area where we could do some reporting. I don't know what mechanisms constitutionally exist, but I don't think it's an easy path. And, doesn't look forward to a circumstance such as
yeah, that. Yeah, and I think you're going to see that talk restrained as long as I'll touch back to what Brian was saying, as long as everybody in this bargain is getting what they want. And the other party that we have not talked about is Congress. As long as Republicans in Congress think that they will get something out of Donald Trump, they're going to be restrained in their confrontations with him. When that stops, that's when you're going to see a renewal, I think, of this argument and some probing. I mean, Hank, yeah, you're right. We can't go to the doctors and say, please tell us what's going on. But Congress has got a couple levers.
And his own the people inside the White House. Pretty soon you're doing your reporting on people with people who are truly worried about the state of the presidency.
Well, that's Bob's point. Don't we have an obligation to report that out?
Absolutely. And they feel it's their patriotic duty not to let this man continue if they believe that he's off balance.
Brian, because we got to get to a break.
My thing is there's nothing that we saw yesterday that we did not see for 18 months before he got elected as president of the United States.
Right.
This was not new erratic behavior now that he's wearing the cloak of the presidency. This is what people knowingly voted for.
All right, we've got to get in a break. It's almost 3:31 on Friday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
My name's Taylor Worley. I'm the reservations manager for the lodge on Little St. Simon's Island. Little St. Simon's Island is a separate island from St. Simon's Island. We only have 16 guest rooms. You can go out to a beach, look left and look right. You don't see a person, a building, or anything. You have it all to yourself for miles.
Why do you underwrite with GPB?
I think it offers the listeners a opportunity to learn more about their state, you know, as well as national subjects. It gives us the opportunity to let people know who we are and that we exist.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
Point.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. That was Hank Klibanoff there. He didn't know the break was over. Hank Klibanoff, of course, former editor of the AJC, former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, teaching journalism now at Emory University. Brian Robinson, former communications director and deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal, and our constant companion on the Monday and Friday shows, Jim Galloway, the political writer and columnist for the Atlanta Constitution, on the phone from New York, on the media co-host Bob Garfield. Not New York. I'm getting a. Not, are you somewhere else?
No, actually, I'm at a. I'm at an undisclosed secure location in the perimeter of Washington,
D.C. Okay. Our producer Jenny Ament quickly shook her head when I said New York City. Real quick, we've got some tweets that we'll get to. You can tweet us, of course, at Politics. GPB. Ross Hardy says, lots of leaks from the White House. As journalists, what are your standards for using anonymous sources? That's a great one.
Great question.
In fact, before we even do more tweets, Jim, this white-hot competition that has really picked up, especially between the New York Times and the Washington Post, which is where all these stories are emerging, almost all of them anonymously sourced. How do we deal with that kind of reporting?
You start by acknowledging that talking to a reporter is an unnatural act. That people don't do it because just they don't wake up in the morning and call Hank Klibanoff. They have a motive. Everybody's got a motive. And it may be earning your paycheck because it's your job. You talk to a reporter. You may be worried about this policy or that policy, but you always have a motive, and that becomes our job. That's where we become the gatekeepers, and we get the information, and then we judge the motive, and we decide whether that motive colors the information itself. If it doesn't,
that's exactly right. And this is, I think, where the coverage of the last week, the feeding frenzy, has really disappointed me, and far more on this subject in this weekend's On the Media. But not only do we have to be aware that anyone leaking information has motives of their own, which may be pure and may not be, but it's our duty to make sure that we contextualize the information so that the audience itself is aware that the sources are people with motives that we know nothing about. So the journalist has to make some judgments, but they have to permit and invite the audience to make the same judgments. Otherwise, what happens is what's happening now. I think stories that raise far more questions than answers are everywhere about the Flynn affair. And yeah. You know, there's a part of me as a citizen that makes me salivate at it all. But as a journalist, I'm deeply, deeply concerned that we are in this as an institution doing to Flynn what Judy Miller did to Dick Cheney, which is to say, pass along bad intelligence without properly contextualizing it. Which led us into, of course, the Iraq War.
Hank, when you have these major stories appearing in the New York Times and the Washington Post, front page, CNN doing a lot of the same kind of work, without any names, what does that do to the credibility among readers of the stories themselves? And does that give Trump an opening for arguing this is all fake news?
I think it makes the news organization very vulnerable. One, if they're wrong and they're using an anonymous source, it can be extremely embarrassing. It really does hurt their credibility. But even when they're right, if time after time after time you're using anonymous sources, people have reason to doubt it. I mean, we had strict standards at the AJC and at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and every major news organization has a very strict standard and practice over what, when you can use an anonymous source and when you can't. In fact, the most rampant section, the most rampant use is usually found in the sports sections, oddly enough. Yeah. And I would say that the question right now is whether these major news organizations are bending their own rules a little bit.
Let me get to just a few more tweets because they're coming in very quickly, and I want to acknowledge them. Dave, who tweets at Vinoy Tapas, says, "How long do we give Trump supporters before they start second guessing their choice?" Dave says, how to deal with the real Donald Trump? Don't ask him multi-part questions. I think that's a really interesting insight, too. It strikes me, Bob, let me start with you. It does strike me, as we've seen these early Trump presidential news conferences, that although we don't like the idea of reporters colluding with one another, finding an organized and coherent line of questioning that, instead of being all over the map, might in fact at least produce some more answers. What do you think?
Well, leave us not forget that they are in competition with one another.
Well, yeah, but still, we...
But what I believe is that if the president shoots down a reporter or treats him the way, for example, he treated that Orthodox Jewish reporter questioning about anti-Semitic acts around the country, and is, I think the next person who's recognized should, be Spartacus and say, I am Spartacus, step forward and ask exactly the same question.
Yeah, it just strikes me.
And if it's not answered, then the next reporter called on should do the same thing. And, you know, at some point, the press as an institution has a goal of not letting itself be
the problem with
aligned
that,
and delegitimized. And if that means forsaking your competitive prerogative in order to protect the institution, be Spartacus.
The problem with this, a Spartacus approach is that then it becomes a conspiracy of the press.
That's right.
And yeah, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and I think it's worth the political risk.
But really, somebody's political instinct repertorial instinct had to be at that press conference yesterday, when the president says we are a fine-tuned machine, and the only thing that and my order was functioning beautifully until the courts got involved. There was a huge lag of time, and someone should have said that is just not true. Your fine-tuned machine was running aground.
If it was a weed whacker, I would say, yeah.
Well, I mean, without regard to the fact that, of course, they're all in competition, in a news conference setting, everyone is going after the information is shared with all the reporters in that room. So my suggestion is that Trump benefits when you've got, in a news conference setting like yesterday, when everybody's all over the map in terms of where they want to go with questions, it allows him to evade almost everything because there's no singular line of thought. So that, for instance, how much more could we have learned about Flynn and what Trump knew? Well, they didn't even ask that question. But how much more might we have learned about that if one reporter after another had thought, instead of their need to ask their own question, to follow up? That's
the Melania question, for example.
Yeah.
Right.
Which
won the president's praise.
Does that make sense to anybody?
It does.
It has game shows. I think you should put them on a timer and have a buzzer or a gong.
But it has to be organic and it has to be real. It has to be natural.
Well, sure. I'm not suggesting collusion.
But you're right. I mean, you expect a reporter, if Galloway asks a question, I'm going to say, that's a great question. He didn't get a complete answer. I'm the next one. You know, I'm going to call an audible, and I'm going to ask a follow-up on that.
All right. Let's turn to another interesting development, and that has to do with Trump's spokespeople. That has to do with Sean Spicer in his daily press briefings, which are now getting great ratings. It has to do, of course, with Kellyanne Conway, and maybe to an extent we saw Stephen Miller's one-day effort on Sunday to be the spokesperson, and that was a little scary. I think many people agree. So let's listen to how the folks at Morning Joe have decided to deal, starting with Kellyanne Conway.
Joe was just saying that she books herself on these shows. We know for a fact she tries to book herself on this show. I won't do it because I don't believe in fake news or information that is not true. And that is every time I've ever seen her on television, something's askew, off, or incorrect.
All right, in keeping with your notion, Bob, that this is the toss-up question for 20 points, should news organizations bar people like, if they don't like the answers they're getting from a spokesperson for the president, is it perfectly fine that they say we're not going to ever use you again? Or, in fact, is there a certain obligation for the for their viewers to be able to see what kind of thinking is coming out of the people who are close to the president?
I can answer that question. It is yes. The please understand the context for this. These are cable news outlets that are practically 24/7 spin rooms. Most of them don't do a whole lot of reporting. Their whole business is to have a bunch of politically inflected characters saying preordained things about every subject under the sun. So, you know, it's not exactly a no-spin zone. It, in fact, spin is their stock in trade. So it's a little odd, especially for a show like Morning Joe, which would have seemed to have traded access for to Trump for sort of,
they've been pretty hard on him for a while now.
campaign. There's a little bit of a hypocrisy there.
Brian?
That said, if someone's coming onto your show and repeatedly lying or evading the question or spinning, except for the metadata that I referred to earlier, they serve no purpose. Why bring someone on just to lie? And I'm sympathetic.
Brian, Leonard Henry tweets, as soon as I hear the media or your guests, and I would assume this includes me, use snark or sarcasm, I discount anything further they have to say.
I take that very personally.
I think you're excluded since you, after all, are the one person here who not currently working as a journalist in any form.
Yes, but if you can't use snark, what's the point of any of this?
what do you say about the use of spokespeople or the refusal to use spokespeople on the shows?
I think that Trump spokespeople have the most difficult job in the world, and I don't know how in the world they go out there and do it. And particularly, they not only go out there to a very hostile media that thinks that what their boss is saying is factually incorrect or crazy, they're also have to worry about getting stabbed in the back from internal leaks at the White House about how Trump's not happy with them, Trump doesn't think they do a good job on camera, et cetera. I mean, that's a really tough place to do that job. And I don't know how somebody like Sean Spicer stays in that job for a very long time. It's impossible. When you're going out there and your boss just said he won the biggest electoral victory since Reagan, and that is demonstrably untrue, not just once, but more than once, what do you do? I mean, do you just go out there every day and say, look, forget what he said, all right, here's what he meant? Because that's really what the job comes down to. That's what Kellyanne Conway does all the time. Here's what she meant to say.
The president said there were 3 million illegal voters. That's what he said. What he was trying to say is no. What he said was
right. That's exactly right.
You've got to understand how foreign this conversation seems to a newspaper reporter, because quite frankly, if somebody lies to me, I simply just don't call them back. I don't take their calls. They don't make it into my copy. It's a really easy decision. On the other hand, I also don't broadcast that I don't talk to them. This is just outside my norms here.
Yeah, but I would argue that you're also in a little bit different situation. And Hank, let me throw it at you. Jim is a columnist and oversees the AJC Insider blog, but he's not a White House reporter who does need to turn to people like Sean Spicer and others in the West Wing to try to get a handle on the news.
Hang on. I got to jump in here. I have had many a time to try to deal with Brian Robinson over here in the governor's office.
Right.
Trying to get a coherent quote out of him.
Oh, no, let me jump in here. You could think that I'm a bad person, but don't ever say that I'm incoherent.
No, you're definitely not.
The fact is that we're talking about a press corps that is deeply experienced, You are talking about people who have been covering these issues for many, many years, and in so many ways are so much more knowledgeable, so much wiser than the president or the top two or three people who come out and brief the press on the most important issues of the day. And they know when he's wrong, and they are responsible for calling him on it. Now, I've had this job of trying to interpret a very inarticulate politician, the governor of Mississippi when I was covering him, Cliff Finch. He could not string a sentence together, and no one could understand where he was going. And so we would, in the press corps, write what we thought he meant. We would do reporting behind it and write what, and the press secretary came to us one day and said, quit doing that. Just write what he says. We said, you don't want that. He said, no, that's what I want. Please just write what he says and quit trying to interpret. And so we did that. And about 2 days later, the press secretary came back to us and said, you know, I take it back. You know, start interpreting what he said. Just come to me, please, and vet it so I can make sure that is, in fact, what he meant. Because he was embarrassing the whole administration, the governor was, with his comments. I think Trump is—I do think, despite what Bob said, that he's very susceptible to overexposure here, and that his use, constant use of the same keywords, disaster, catastrophe, mess, the hyperbole will wear thin over time, and he will lose support as a result of that.
And, Bob, you don't think that's going to happen. You think that those hardcore Trump people are sticking with him.
Oh, I don't know. I've got to get out of the predictions business because I've been wrong about absolutely everything the last 18 months.
Yeah, yeah, so we're all in the same club.
I will recuse myself.
All right, we got to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll finish up our conversation about Trump and the media. This is Political Rewind at 3:47.
Rorschach's famous ink blots.
A lot of people do dismiss them.
But writer Damien Searle says those dismissals are out of date. The Rorschach test works.
The real test is not that if you see a bouncing bunny, you're the good twin, and if you see an axe murderer, you're the bad twin.
I'm Robert Siegel. Herman Rorschach's symmetrical blobs and where they came from. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's this afternoon from 4 till 7 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Bob Garfield from On the Media joins us by phone. Jim Galloway, Brian Robinson, and Hank Klibanoff are in the studio. I want to read you all a quote and get your response to it. Because, it's this whole notion of an outsider who had no chance to win the White House and who comes to Washington without any understanding of the way the system works. This is out of Newsweek. He is trying out of a secure sense that he is at one with the people and that the people constitute a body larger than the sum of its parts. He has sought to please them by being precisely the sort of president he promised to be, an activist in impulse. He's got his charter to reconstruct the government, and he has begun blueprinting its use. Jim Galloway, May 2nd. 1977.
I was saying, I was thinking that exactly what I was thinking of.
And Newsweek goes on, and in that article, to talk about the chaos in the Carter administration.
Right, and I mean, the Peanut Brigade inhabited the White House. They had no coherent contact with Congress. That would only develop over a couple of years. They had, both chambers were under Democratic control. You'd mm-hmm. see this. You would see Teddy Kennedy jump up and become Carter's chief nemesis during those years.
And run against him,
right. And cost him a second term.
All right. So if it's true if Jimmy Carter, and of course Jimmy Carter faced, I mean Jimmy Carter could not get his legislative agenda passed with any real help from leadership on the Hill. He had the Burt Lance crisis. Burt Lance had to resign as budget director because of all of the financial conflicts that were exposed about him. And Carter never did find his footing in Washington, I think many people would say. Now, he faced some circumstances Donald Trump doesn't. I mean, inflation completely out of control. The fuel crisis was overwhelming. But Bob, do you see parallels between President Jimmy Carter, our own Georgia boy, and what Donald Trump's dealing with? Or more to the point, is Donald Trump something unlike anything we've seen in the history of presidents?
Once again, the answer to both questions is yes. There are definitely parallels. I mean, I remember how much Congress and the staffs on the Hill hated Jordan.
Powell.
And Hamilton and Jordan.
They just thought they were these, you know, carpetbaggers coming in trying to show them how to run Washington. And you know, institutional Washington was having none of it. But, of course, neither Hamilton Jordan nor Jody Powell was a white nationalist. Neither of them were proposing anti-constitutional measures. They weren't telling a string of lies almost pathologically. And, you know, everything that is similar about the Trump administration to anything else is totally outweighed by how different the Trump administration is to anything else.
I mean,
is a singular moment in American political history, and it's horrible.
Yeah, they were coming in after the Nixon years. They were on a messianic mission to reform Washington, but that was a true crisis, the Nixon years. When you hear Donald Trump say he has inherited a mess
yeah.
That he suddenly has this mission to change everything. I just think surely people don't believe that we were in as dire a circumstance over the last year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, as we were back in 1974, 75.
And keep in mind that Jimmy Carter went into D.C. saying, "I will never lie to you." Mm-hmm. And I have not yet heard Donald Trump say that.
Well, okay. Barbara S. tweets, "It was clear 18 months ago that he is temperamentally unfit for the presidency. The presser simply confirmed that." Kevin says, "Thank you for disseminating thoughtful, sane information, or as Donald Trump would call it, fake news." We've got other tweets from "The public needs these questions asked," says the one who knocks. "You must ask them. But remember that moment yesterday, you're the president." Good answer. I'm not. I guess we have to show a certain respect for this president, even as we battle with him in these settings.
Certainly, I would offer him every deference, and I would say, you know, you don't shout at him, you don't scream at him. Every move like that loses you, loses you support.
It does, but let us not forget, please, that he's nobody to tell a reporter to sit down. He is the public servant. The reporter doesn't work for him, and while there should be respect for the office and respect for, you know, any human being, he's not a monarch, and there is no bowing or curtsying necessary. All you have to do is follow the golden rule, but beyond that, you know, too much deference is exactly what, you know, got us into this fix.
Yeah, Brian, you wouldn't have suggested that Governor Deal talk to the media the way that Donald Trump did yesterday, would you? Sit down. The things that Bob's talking about now, be quiet. I'm talking. Sit down, whatever. Is that really the way you do it?
Nothing that he does is the way it's ever been done before. Nothing that he does at any point in time before did someone think that's the right way to do it. That's the strategy. You know, those who did that type of behavior usually got a very negative response. They were attacked by the media. They were cowered, and they changed tactics. And he has never changed tactics. He just plows forward. And the fact is, it's a tactic for him that has been very successful. The media's approval ratings are lower than Donald Trump. That's one thing we need to keep in mind here. The media, why did you treat us like this? Why is he so mean? He is speaking to the audience behind those cameras, you know, not the ones in the room. He's speaking to the people in the gym, the people in their living rooms, the people in their offices. And they think the same thing. Those folks don't understand me. They think we're flyover country. They're arrogant. They're liberal. And he has played on that masterfully. He's not crazy. In some ways, he's genius.
All right. Well, then I have kind of a final wrap-up question for all of you, if I may. Hank, let me start with you. If, in fact, it's true that Donald Trump's attacks on the intelligence community have led to and been responded to by leaking from the community negative information about President Trump, if they've decided they're in a war with him because he started it, is there a parallel here in terms of the way he, despite our attempts to be as professional as possible, Is he starting a war with the media that the media will respond to, we hope within the guidelines of good journalism, but that could spiral in some ways out of control?
You know, I think his greatest threat is from within. I think the threat that he has to is ultimately will have to deal with is from those around him, from the other Republican legislators in Washington, from staffers, from the minions all around him. If they believe that he is doing great damage to the government, I think they'll start speaking quietly in their own way to reporters, and reporters will do their job.
But Bob, if the coverage is relentlessly negative, as Trump accuses it of being now, but if it is some of that because the media has decided they must continue to go after this guy and they're ignoring the positive stories? Is there that impulse at work, do you think?
The media go for news, and politicians are often stunned to find out what they believe is newsworthy doesn't conform with what journalists believe is newsworthy. It's not necessarily what's in the press release. It's what the most impactful story of the day is. So if the president has achieved anything good, and, you know, that's an open question, it's simply been, you know, usurped by all of the antisocial behavior that he's engaged
good,
in.
Good.
But his big problem is not with the press. He declared war on the press. His problem is, you know, if there were five senators in the Senate and maybe 20 Republicans in the House and some people in the White House with the knives out and half the intelligence community are all arrayed against him, He's going to have big problems.
Jim, let me look. You get a last word.
I think in the final act, the media is going to become the medium only, and I think it's going to be the actors in the various institutions in Washington that are providing the information that are going to. I'd agree with Hank on this. It's going to be the intelligence community. It'll be Congress. It'll be the White House staff.
Yeah. And when it comes to the media, what I think the message may be on this is that there may be good news that comes out of the White House, but if Trump doesn't stop stepping on it, that's his problem, not the media's.
You know what was genius about yesterday's news conference and maybe why he did it? You know two words that we have not said around this table today? Flynn or Russia. That was the entire conversation of this week before yesterday, and he changed the conversation. He does it anytime there's a persistent negative story.
All right. We are completely out of time. I don't know how I feel about giving the last word to a guy who is a press spokesman for an elected official. But Brian Robinson, thank you so much for your participation today. Bob Garfield, we really appreciate your joining us from Washington on the media Sundays at noon here on Georgia Public Radio statewide. Hank Klibanoff, Jim Galloway, we're going to take a weekend and enjoy it unless, who knows, big news seems to blow up in the Trump administration on weekends. And if it does, we'll be back Monday at 2 o'clock to talk all about it. See y'all then.